So this morning we're looking at points 3, 4, and 5 of the Dasadhammas, the reflections that are to be done again and again by one who has gone forth. So when we, Hemisphere and I met, sort of brainstorm, initially we thought of only using the first line of the sutta, which I've forgotten, I must go forth from worldly aims and values, or... and then as we read the others, we thought, actually, they're all interesting and they're all variations on a theme, really. So this one is the ethical dimension of that. And in a way, it is about going forth from worldly aims and values, but particularly in the arena of ethics. So I'll just read the translation that we're using, and then I'll also read the variants in translation. So I should strive to abandon my former habits, is the first one, number 3. So you can see the connection with leaving behind worldly aims and values, but it's focusing particularly on habits. The other translations of that one are, I must now behave in a different manner, which is very similar. My behaviour should be different from a householder. And we're not dividing ourselves into monastic and lay. So Subhuti's reflection on this, which he devised for a reflection with the Indian order members, is a little fuller and says, as an order member, I live according to different values to most people, with ethical standards not shared deeply by others. I have a goal most others don't have. I belong to a community with shared values and goals. My life should be different, is it? So, yeah, I should strive to abandon my former habits. So that's the kind of going forth, isn't it, from whatever habit patterns are holding you back in your spiritual life or unskilled. The fourth Dasadhamma says, does regret over my conduct arise in my mind? So this is Sri, isn't it? We're the next two are Sri and Apatrapya. So this is Sri. Does regret over my conduct arise in my mind? And the other translations are quite similar. Can I fault myself with regard to my virtue? One of them says, does my mind upbraid me regarding the state of my virtue? I meant to look up what upbraid meant and I forgot.
Improved.
It sounds sort of reproved. Yeah, I thought it was quite strong. And Subhuti says, as an order member committed to the 10 pillars and going for refuge to the 3 jewels, a high goal and a lofty standard, do I examine myself to see if I have fallen short? With a tender conscience, can I feel free? So does regret over my conduct arise in my mind? And then number 5 is, could my spiritual companions find fault with my conduct? So here we're in Apatrapya. So the other translations, they're just interesting, slightly different. Do my discerning fellow monks, having tested me, reprove me regarding the state of my virtue? I like the next one. Can my fellows in the Dharma life on close examination fault me with regard to my virtue? So it's quite interesting that they both have discernment, testing, close examination. So you need to know someone well. And Subhuti's is, I am an order member with those who share my lofty goals. My failures are their failures. Do I open myself to their reflection on me, their reflection on my unskillfulness and ignorance? Do I humbly accept their comment and act upon it? Do I approach them regularly in a spirit of apatrapya? So, I'm going to talk, before I go into them in more detail, I'm going to talk about sort of ethics in general. And when we talked about this, it seemed apparent that one of the great paradigm shifts that we're asked to make as practitioners in the realm of ethics, or in the realm of life, really, is the shift from the power mode to the love mode, which we've already talked about to some degree. But I wanted to go into that a bit more again before we go into the sort of details. So, yeah, I'd quite like to revisit that territory, the complete giving up or renouncing of any kind of power, whether gross or subtle. And I have great interest in the whole idea of renouncing blame, which I think is part of giving up the power mode. It's one of my favourite topics, which I try to renounce. So I'm going to draw on Bante's 1984, it's a paper, wasn't it, on the Ten Pillars, where he talks about the power mode and the love mode. I'm going to draw on the Dhammapada, and I'm going to draw on some of the mind-turning teachings. So it's very interesting that we were founded in 1968. Nothing's happening. Yeah, we were founded in 1968, so everybody ordained from 1968 to 1984 had taken the 10 precepts, and presumably we tried to put them into practice. But it wasn't until 1984 that Bante did this. It was at a WBO day. You were there, weren't you? WBO day in York Hall? Some room in York Hall? Yeah. So often WBO days in those days, if Bante was around, he would take that as an opportunity to present us with some new teaching. And this was a very long paper, 4 hours, which was read by others because
Bante started and then his voice went through.
So it was Sri Mala and David Mitra. So it was a whole day of this paper being read. And what was interesting about it was a secret what it was going to be about. So he kept it a secret, he didn't tell us. So we were all thinking, what's it going to be? What's he going to tell us?
Nagabodhi
knew. And I don't think any of us thought it would be on the 10 precepts. I think we thought it would be much more exciting, sort of tantric, and or it would be much more, I don't know, challenging in some other way. Maybe it would be the wreath of blue lotuses or something. Anyway, go back there. So that was just quite interesting that, that's Bante, so many years after. I'm sure he talked about ethics, but, unfolding those 10 precepts in the way that he did in that paper, which has formed the basis for retreats and the ordination training. So I think it's some of his reflections, isn't it, on those precepts. He's kind of taken it for granted that we know what they are, but then he kind of has his own reflection. I suppose one of the great reflections is the kind of depth with which he goes into that first precept. It's not just about not killing folks, although that's very important. He talks about this whole shift from the power mode to the love mode. So he goes very, very deeply, as he does, into topics, dharmic topics. So I think that was very, very exciting at the time. And if we reflect on it, it's still exciting, isn't it, really? So he says that shifting from the power mode to the love mode, from harm to non-harm, is the most direct and most important manifestation of the spiritual act of going for refuge. It's non-violence. And he also says that as a result of our imaginative identification with others, there takes place within us a change so great as to amount to a change in our centre of gravity, so to speak. So, you have this sense of this paradigm shift, this shift from power to love. And he says in the seminar on the Ten Pillars, he says, if we were to go deeply enough into the first precept, we would be almost enlightened. So it's not just a precept as a rule, is it? It's not just even as a rule of training. It's looking so deeply into the principle of that first precept, and that first precept underpins all the others. So yeah, it's a huge shift for us to make that shift, isn't it, from power and all its manifestations to love. And he says it will take time. So he reminds us that, that metta is foundational to that, and also that non-violence or love, which he equates, is a principle. And given that it is a principle, there's no limits to the number of ways that we can apply that. And it should naturally manifest in more and more areas of our life. And applies not only to people, but to animals and to the environment. And love is infinite. In a seminar I was on with him on the dual ornament, I was on the seminar of benevolence and compassion in, I think it was the 80s, those seminars. He's talking about love, and it's one of his, I don't know if it's ever been published anywhere else, but it's, you know, an aphoristic saying of Vante where he says, love is warm but not clammy, hot but not sticky. Which I always really liked. So it's interesting when we look at the precepts, they're very much involved with purification, on the purification of body, speech and mind when we do the positive precepts. But when we come to the mind precepts, there is again this sense of a change, a transformation. We abandon covetousness for tranquility. We change hatred into compassion, and we transform ignorance into wisdom. So this sense of, you know, a turning around in our mental attitude with those mind precepts. So yeah, we're trying to bring about a radical shift in our mental attitudes from any kind of harm or power to a mind totally infused with metta, the love mode, which of course is bodhicitta. And the expression of that love is solidarity with all life, isn't it, with all beings, and that ability to put ourselves in place of another, to put ourselves in the shoes of others, and to respond to others with a cherishing, nurturing, protecting love. So yeah, I just want to sort of look at the whole area of blame, giving up on blame, as part of renouncing the power mode. And I've done quite a lot of study on the mind training. I think I've been interested in the mind training and studying it, trying to put it into practice. I don't know, maybe it's 15 years or something. Coming across the 7-point mind training, which is a Tibetan version of the mind training, and the 8 verses of Langri Tangpa. So Parim and I have done sort of several retreats on these, and we've done retreats and study on them separately. And those texts, they're texts about cultivating bodhicitta, so you're trying to bring about a new mind without power, based on that kind of love, that cherishing love. And central to those teachings, in order to bring about bodhicitta, is the whole focus on what's called taking difficulties onto the path. So, and that involves not reacting or retaliating, seeing all beings as precious, renouncing blame, taking responsibility, and it includes some very challenging aphorisms or verses or slogans. And my experience of this doing this study is that people find it very, very challenging. So often what people say, I did some study with some of the order members in mainland Europe, I think it was a couple of years ago, we were studying the 8 verses, and yeah, you're trying to renounce blame, you're trying to, I'll go into some of those verses in a little bit, you're trying to see people who seem to do things to you, bad things to you, as precious as your, you know, great spiritual friends, and people find it challenging. So people are saying things like, well, we can't teach this to beginners, and I'm saying, well, we're not, are we? We're sitting here studying it as an order. Somebody said, and this often gets said, but I didn't sign up for this. And I, oh, yes, you did. I'm sorry, but you did. I know it's challenging, but, you know, that to develop non-harm, it's the kind of essential nature of Buddhism, isn't it? But, yeah. So people kind of get kind of antsy and kind of flouncy and reactive. Even when, you know, studying the Bodhicharya, the same thing happens. And it's because it is really so challenging. I was talking to Paramatha this morning when he was giving me a session. I can't remember what he was telling me, something that was difficult. And I said, oh, yeah, we have to lean into the difficulties, don't we? Which is one of the approaches of the mind training. You don't go, you go, okay. And he said, yeah, sounds great on paper, doesn't it? Which is true, isn't it? So I think it challenges, doesn't it, all kinds of resistances and rationalizations, and you know, challenges deeply held assumptions and views. But if we go back to the Dhammapada, this is an essential teaching, isn't it? Those who entertain such thoughts as "he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me" will not still their hatred. Those who do not entertain such thoughts as "he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me" will still their hatred. Not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified. Here in the world they are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. So there it is, right back in the Dhammapada. And that gets taken up by Shantideva in his exchange of self and other, and all his kind of wonderful, sometimes it seems like mental gymnastics. He's trying to convince you, you know, not to retaliate, not to respond. You know, they have the stick, but you've got the body. You have to take responsibility for being there. and then that's followed through into these mind training teachings. So yeah, this connects very much with, we should strive to abandon all my former habits. We should strive to abandon all unskillful actions of body, speech and mind, and abandon the power mode and cultivate the love mode. And sometimes it's put that we need to give up the advantages of the power mode, which I think is quite interesting, because obviously we wouldn't be doing it. Well, I come on a little bit more to why we react in the ways we do, but you know, in our mind somewhere, in our instincts, we feel there's an advantage to retaliating, getting the best of people, competing, and all those kind of things. So it's a kind of strategy, but it's a kind of misplaced strategy, isn't it? Because it doesn't really help in the deepest sense or in the long run. But we want to get what we want, so that's what we do sometimes. And we're caught in the power mode, aren't we? Because we still have, or to the extent that we still have, a fixed view of self. So some kind of separate self that we need to protect in some way, that's central and important to us, which, you know, is kind of, that's how that works, isn't it? It's a kind of, it's a given, isn't it, in our makeup, that sense of self. Those atmaklesas, from the Yogacara point of view, they're very, very deep in our Klisto Manavijnana. So that, any kind of degree of separation or sense of self, self-love, self-pride, self-delusion, self-view, self-affection, leads to all kinds of power expressions, subtle coercion, competitiveness, rivalry, comparison, envy, jealousy, pride. And this whole thing about trying to get one's, what one thinks, well, the most important needs, my needs, met, sometimes without considering the consequences or the effect on others or on the world. And when that kind of sense of self gets threatened, we fall into all kinds of rationalisation. We feel right, we feel righteous indignation, we have a desire for retaliation. And we also feel that someone is responsible, not us. Someone is to blame. Sometimes we do blame ourselves, I'm going to come on to that as well, but someone is to blame. So blame, I don't know if there's an actual, it's a translation of an actual Sanskrit or Pali word, but anyway, it's kind of in the area of resentment, grudge holding, and the desire for revenge, isn't it? And there's a quote from Attila, I don't know where this comes from, but anyway, this is an Attila quote, which I like, where he says, entering a spiritual community requires us to give up blame. We're entering a ritual space where events are endowed with a completely different significance and where the ordinary ways of looking at the world do not apply. So entering a spiritual community requires us to give up blame. We are entering a ritual space where events are endowed with a completely different significance and where the ordinary ways of looking at the world do not apply. So I'm not saying that this is an easy task or that we can do it all at once, but you know, we have signed up in the sense that we've gone for refuge and committed ourselves to practice those precepts, and the first precept in that deep sense of the love mode, we have committed ourselves to continually trying to give up power and all its lovely manifestations. So blame arises when something happens to us, isn't it? Someone says something, does something to us, and it can be from the really, really bad to the really quite minor. And we feel, for whatever reason, we feel hurt. We have offended pride. You can feel it, can't you? You know? Diminished, humiliated, made small. We're offended. We can feel self-righteous. We have righteous indignation. And I think the response to that is very deep and visceral and instinctive. And I think we just need to understand that you know, it kind of happens. It probably happens in one of these back brain things that people talk about who do neuroscience. It's probably slightly a survival technique, isn't it? It's fight or flight, and we fight in some way. I think it's instinctive, and there's a kind of instinctive desire to sort of right the balance, put the balance right. You've lost your balance, you've been knocked off your spot in some way, your ego's been knocked off its spot, and there's a kind of, you want to kind of even out the ground again. And so I think it's deeply instinctive. So I think that it just adds to our understanding of the task we have to turn that around. So we want to even things out. That may arise as we want to get our own back in some way or pay back in some way. And even if we restrain the kind of more gross aspects of kind of lashing out or retaliation, we play scenarios out in our mind, don't we? Often. So, you know, it happens mentally. So we may be a more hot anger type, and we may not be able to restrain ourselves so much because we're of that type, or we might be a sort of more slow burn, resentment, grudge holding type. That's me. I'm one of them. I can blow, actually. I do blow sometimes, but my tendency, my conditioning is one of those. So you brood over past hurts. And one of the mind training slogans that I really like, I like it, but because it's kind of, is don't wait in ambush. And when I came across that, I said, oh God, that's so old. So I don't like it in the sense I like it, but I kind of think that's so good, isn't it? Don't wait in ambush. So, don't wait in ambush. And there's a Marshall Rosenberg in the nonviolent communication work. You know, he has kind of giraffes and jackals. He has puppets, doesn't he? The giraffe is love and the jackal is... You have to let your jackal out. And he has this category that he calls a yay-saying jackal. So the yay-saying jackal is someone who goes, things happen to you, and you go, okay, let's not, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes. He says... And then you blow, and everybody plays. So you kind of say yes, until you just can't do it anymore, and then you go, argh! And that's me. That's my kind of conditioning, my habit with my older brother from when I was tiny. So then you blow, and everybody goes, what? So it used to happen when I was tiny with my brother. He was bigger than me, so he could kind of boss me around. And then I'd kind of wait. I was only wee, you know, I'd wait till he was kind of unaware. And then I'd try and get my own back. And then we both get sent to bed. And I think that was so unfair. He'd done this thing to me and didn't anybody notice what he'd done. Then when he came back to England, you know, like so many years later, same dynamic. You know, I go back to being 3, he's 5, and we have a falling out. As siblings sometimes do. So that's one way of kind of responding, is to kind of, you know, lie in ambush. Some people just respond immediately, don't they? They're kind of much more hot in the moment. And I think, I don't know if Parmi would agree with me here, but I think hot anger people get a worse press. Not that resentment is, you know, very nice, but, you know, sometimes because it's kind of out there, isn't it? And it has an effect, doesn't it? But anyway, when you blow eventually as a yay-saying jackal, everybody goes, I thought she was so nice.
Yeah, we didn't ever think that, but the whole
thing. Anyway. Yeah, so anyway, this is all about we think someone is responsible, someone is to blame. Who is the culprit? And... that, you know, that leads us into wanting someone to pay, and that might be another individual, or it might be an organisation, or take them to some kind of litigation, or I think sometimes we take the moral high ground. It's the righteous indignation, isn't it? It's got body language, isn't it? Or sometimes we scapegoat somebody. You know, all those things are kind of part of this, part and parcel, aren't they? But when we're doing this, when we're blaming externally, we're not to blame. Someone else is to blame. And we don't want them to get away with it, and we are right. Came across a quote, I haven't put where I got the quote from, but it says, vengeance is the ego's way of avoiding grief. It's good, isn't it? So there's pain, there's hurt, and you kind of lash out, you know, because you can't bear to face that hurt. So in all this work in the mind training, and what comes from the Dharmapada and turning around the power mode, we're not saying that there may not have been harm done. Mm-hmm. Harm may well have been done. Or even that justice is not appropriate. You know, real justice is not appropriate. Or that we should be doormats, which is often what people think when they kind of approach this material from our own particular set of conditionings, I think. So we need to speak up about injustice. We need to have boundaries sometimes, don't we? You need to be able to say, you know, yay saying jackal, should say no much, much earlier on, clearly. And it's not about taking the blame for everything that happens to us from a karmic point of view, because we need a kind of thorough understanding of the niyamas. What it's saying is we have a choice about how we respond to what happens to us. That's, you know, that's the edge of the work, isn't it? We have that choice. Only we have that choice, really. And the Buddha taught there's no justification for hatred. In those lines in the Dhammapada, and, you know, there's the parable of the saw, even if somebody's sawing off your limbs, you're given to hatred, you are not one of my disciples. There's the monks who hear the Buddha being run down, and they get kind of cross and go into righteous indignation, and the Buddha says, what did I teach you about non-violence, etc. So it is, you know, it is a very deep thing that we're trying to work on. And in the mind training, the approach of taking difficulties onto the path is seeing obstacles as an opportunity, seeing all obstacles as opportunities to wake up. And the mind training says, to do that, you don't need great learning, but you do need great courage. Mm-hmm. So that shift is all about, it's all about taking responsibility for ourselves, isn't it? So one of the slogans in the mind training is, drive all blames into one. Mm-hmm. They're good, the slogans, because you sort of remember them, even if you can't remember all 50, whatever of them. Some of them kind of all stick in your mind. So that isn't about neurotic self-blame, which I'm going to come on to. It's a sort of understanding of the way things are and seeing that it's our own ego clinging that gives rise to suffering. We are still living in that subject-object self-other power mode dichotomy. So, you know, our responsibility is to ask, what did I contribute to that situation? It may only be that we were there, but we were there. And we're trying to see whatever situation without our habitual biases and projections. And the mind training texts say, well, so often we blame others when something happens to us, but we do the same things. We do the same things to others, and we're much more lenient with ourselves sometimes. So yes, you can use reflections like that. Well, everything happens because of ego clinging. That's one sort of set of reflections, isn't it? We can also reflect that, well, stuff happens, isn't it? Stuff happens. We can't fix samsara. We can't live a kind of totally cocooned, safe life in which nothing ever happens to us and nobody ever dies and nobody ever leaves us and nobody ever says anything slightly unkind to us or nobody ever puts the rubbish out, you know. We just can't live. We don't live in a world like that, do we? So we live in samsara, we live in the world. There's dukkha. and all those things happen. And in a way, it's like having you need a deeper understanding, don't you, of the nature of conditioned existence. I think Parami was talking, you were talking about this yesterday, weren't you, about the Lakshans. Dukkha, impermanence, insubstantiality. And we need to let go of a certain naivety, I think, or the views, see the views that underpin a certain kind of naivety that life's supposed to be fair. Mm-hmm. It just so isn't fair. It isn't fair. In all kinds of ways. Without falling to cynicism. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, an emergence from a certain kind of naivety that you have to look at your own kind of views that underpin that sort of naivety. Is it that, you know, life should be fair? Or what is the view underneath it? It's not fair, it shouldn't happen to me, why me, etc., etc. And you have to go to a much deeper place in yourself, don't you? A deeper place of love and a deeper place of faith. So Shraddha is very, very, very important, isn't it? The deeper our Shraddha, the more we can lean into difficulties. And also forgiveness and Kshanti. Kshanti is the great antidote to blame in the mind training teachers. Mm. And this whole thing about just being able to turn towards whatever difficulty, turn towards pain in ourselves, turn towards obstacles when we can. So drive all blames into one, which is kind of just seeing that suffering arises from this illusion of a separate ego. And the following aphorism is interesting because it says, be grateful to everyone for everything. So beings are precious because they provide us with many of those opportunities to wake up. They're precious to us. So this is quite clear in the eight verses of Langri Tangpa. I don't know if you've come across these eight verses. They're very good to study. I think there are some talks on Free Buddhist Audio on the eight verses by various folk. I'm just going to pin...
By you.
By me, is there? Oh, by me even.
Could you spell that?
Langri Tangpa. Langri Tangpa. Langri Tangpa, eight verses. It's quite a late version of the mind training. Later, I think. So in the first verse, the main kind of point of the first verse is that we cherish all beings as precious and we desire their highest good. So you set your aspiration of bodhicitta in the first verse. In the second verse, it's interesting, we work against pride, so we work against atmanas, the whole thing about pride, because we're willing to treat other beings as honoured guests and serve them with love and respect. The third verse is we resolve to deal with our own kleshas, with our own inner hindrances. So these are sort of preparatory. And then we come on to the next verses where we're trying to take difficulties onto the path. So there's three situations. So the first one is when we meet a difficult person. So this is just someone who's difficult. They're not. It's not personal. We just come across them. They're, it says, ill-natured or they're bad-tempered. Or they're overcome in some way by some kind of oppression. You know, they're suffering in some way and they're around us in some way. So rather than respond to them with some kind of aversion, we see them as a treasure trove. We're always trying to see the others as precious to us because they act as a mirror and they show us where we're at. So I was thinking, well, what's an example of this recently in my life? And I was thinking, well, you know, I live in London, big city, lots of people. You're always crammed in tubes, buses, you know, with people you don't know from a bar of soap. And there seems to be quite often on the 254 bus someone who smells very badly and they come and sit next to you. So, you know, it's not personal to me in any way whatsoever. I just happen to be on that bus and they come sit next to me. And it's very hard, isn't it, not to kind of go, you know, to not, you know, just to shrink and turn and kind of... Actually, it's not just in London. There was a train from Birmingham to Colwall that I was on a while back. somebody was on the train, and everybody was kind of, it was really, really bad. It was kind of, so you kind of close in, don't you, go into some kind of aversion. So while you may try not to breathe, that's fine, isn't it? You might just find it easy just not to breathe till the next stop or something. I guess you're also trying to, yeah, just not go into more aversion than, or more kind of just protection than you need, and kind of just go into a whole story about that person. Because that person is unfortunate. You know, they don't realise often, do they? They're having that effect. And, you know, what their home circumstances, are they homeless? They just happen to be in a bus? Or, I don't know. It's trying to just, isn't it, just kind of open up to that person and the situation they find themselves in. So then it gets personal in the next verse. It's personal. So the verse says, someone has done you wrong out of envy. And the verse says, you need to give them the victory and accept the defeat. Now, this is the verse that everybody goes, no, not going to do that. No, I didn't sign up for this. And I think what it's asking us to do is to step out of that whole paradigm of victory and defeat, really, and sort of step out of the power mode, because that's all about victory and defeat, isn't it? And step out of the paradigm of battle and respond with love. Don't play the game. Don't just caught up in the game of retaliation. You know, someone is behaving in an unpleasant way to you. Just don't fall into... Just don't fall into it if you possibly can. You just got to sort of get bigger, haven't you? And sort of at least non-harm, non-retaliation, non-aggression, even if it can't be love, compassion, you know, just hold. You once asked Bhante, didn't you, a little while ago about what you needed to develop spiritually, and he said... total objectivity, which we've been trying to unpack ever since, haven't we? What does that mean? Total objectivity. There's something about, isn't there, a perspective, a sort of... on a situation, trying to hold something. And it's just very, very hard, isn't it? And also this kind of... I haven't got the verse here, actually, but this giving up the... giving the victory, taking the defeat, it is also a verse in the Dhammapada. So it's taken from early Buddhism. So then it gets really, really personal in this set of verses. someone close to us, who we have trusted, who we've kind of invested some kind of hope in, you know, in what they may do for us or help us with, you know, in a spiritual context, I guess, because this is a teaching to practitioners. Has let us down. So we had hopes and expectations of them, and in some way they've let us down. So that's quite hard to deal with, isn't it? Yeah. Not easy. So all sorts of things get triggered when that happens to us. It might not be in a spiritual context, it might be the end of a love affair. That's often where we feel let down, isn't it? It's one of the big areas where we feel, as we say, betrayed. So we're triggered into all kinds of feelings. We might feel rage, outrage. We can feel deeply hurt, let down, shocked, devastated, humiliated, alienated. We've been such a fool. Why did we kind of, you know, invest? Well, our world's falling apart. We're in despair. We're in grief. And it's, you know, after all I've done for you, you've done this. It's all that, isn't it? Kind of very, very strong response to feel let down in whatever way it is. And we're being asked to see these people as excellent spiritual friends. It is very, very challenging, this whole kind of renouncing of blame. So again, if we're faced, if we can sort of turn towards our feelings and kind of hold them in some kind of greater perspective. We're faced with our naivety and our unreasonable expectations, our illusions, our not understanding deeply enough the way things are. So if you've done any non-violent communication or compassionate communication, blame is something that you work on quite often in those kind of scenarios, in those trainings. And those of us who've done some of that work have been told, and then we know, that you cannot say, "I feel betrayed." Betrayed is not a feeling. So many things end in ED, according to non-violent communication, and this is incredibly helpful, actually. They're not feelings, they're interpretations and judgments, because when you say, "I feel betrayed," you assume that someone else set out to betray you. There's other examples. Mm-hmm. Any other?
Judged.
Unseen, misunderstood. Yeah. So that, you know, you're it's out there, isn't it? You know, you've done this to me. So I remember doing a non-violent communication weekend at Chiranaloka, where someone in the group had you know, a very, very painful end of a relationship, and she said, "I feel betrayed." And I remember Bridget saying, "It's not a feeling," and there was quite a strong discussion or argument about that. So it's not that you don't feel something very strongly, but you have to find out what the feeling is. I'm hurt. I feel really hurt. I'm upset. I feel desperate, you know, whatever it is. I feel like my life's falling apart. I feel like kind of, you know that. So you have to get to the feeling, and not, you know, because otherwise you're caught up in the blame. So that's just very, very interesting sort of reflection to sort of notice when you say something like that. Is it a feeling or is it a judgment of someone else's behaviour? And I remember what she said, Bridget. She said, well, because, you know, you're talking about feelings and needs in the non-violent communication, that the other person had a different need. They had a need for freedom. Mm-hmm. They ended the relationship with you. They had a need for freedom. Quite hard to, isn't it, just open out to think, oh gosh, I guess, you know, you're trying to put yourself in the shoes of another, aren't you? They didn't mean to hurt you, but they didn't still want to be in this situation. Maybe they didn't do it well. Strange point. so they didn't. They might have done it clumsily, they might have done it better, etc., etc. But they didn't set out to betray you. Mm. I think it may be. I don't know if it's Banti or James Hillman talking about betrayal, where he says betrayal, and, you know, we're kind of moving into a slightly different discourse, is an entry into a new kind of consciousness. So you have to sort of, you know, if you're going to work with it, you have to just kind of open up and look at things differently. You have to embrace, hold all those difficult feelings. And I think he says you enter the desert, and the desert is a wonderful place where everything becomes clear. So if you can be in the desert with those feelings of loss and aloneness and etc. So there is a whole essay by James Hillman about betrayal, and he's talking about it in a slightly different way, and he starts with a story, which I won't go into the story, but you can find the essay online. People find it really quite helpful, it seems. So he's talking about a story about betrayal, and he does talk about that we're all going to, he's just going to use it as a feeling, it's a different kind of discourse, but we're all going to feel some sense of betrayal somewhere along the line. We cannot live in the Garden of Eden where nothing bad happens to us. We have to grow up, we have to mature, we have to leave the Garden of Eden. So, yeah, something's going to happen to us which is going to hurt, and then we need to, you know, we need to work with that and turn it around and work creatively with it. And he says so often, the first time in life that something happens to you, or the major thing happens to you that really, really hurts. And it often is, you know, maybe a bereavement, or maybe the loss of a love affair, or maybe you're attacked, you know, in some way, physically attacked. That's very kind of difficult, isn't it? That's never happened to you before. You're mugged, or, you know, you lose faith, don't you, in the world and humanity. And he says there's all sorts of sort of strategies and reactions you can fall into which are not helpful, but you can get kind of stuck in. So one of them is resentment, which we've talked about. You just kind of endlessly brood over the incident that happened. I think it's sort of wonderful image in literature of somebody getting stuck, isn't it, is Miss Havisham in Great Expectations. Mm. Kind of stood up at the altar on her wedding day, and she never moves beyond that. So she's, you know, the wedding feast is there, it's all covered in cobwebs, she's still in her wedding dress, and it's so many, you know, I don't know, years later, and not only that, but, you know, she works towards vengeance on all men through Estella. It's a very, very strong image of, resentment and revenge. So revenge is the next one, which we've talked about. Don't lie in ambush. But the other one...
I'm just being... Is that
no, it's gone.
Well,
is
that a horn?
Yeah.
I put it out once already.
Oh, God. Anyway. Just carry on. Just
wait for it to land somewhere we can catch it.
Yeah. I'll keep breathing because I hate them. I'm phobic. So we go on to denial of the positive, which I think is a really interesting thing that happens. So someone... You know, it's particularly that verse where someone we invested a lot in, you know, we put a lot of our expectation and hopes in, something happens, they don't do what we want them to do, and they fall off their pedestal. And all their previously good qualities, which we raved on about, are as nothing. Love and hate, thin line between love and hate, as Chrissy Hines sang many years ago. So we kind of know that, don't we? And, you know, it can happen in the spiritual community, can't it? You know. Can happen with individuals in the spiritual community because the stakes are so high and the projections can be strong, and you know, we expect perfection, and people are human, Dante's human, pedestals off. So yes, that happens, a denial of the positive. I always knew he was, I always knew she was. You have to look out for the little sort of phrases that you use, don't you? And you need to sort of look at yourself and your own faults and failings, you know. Let he, she who is without sin cast the first stone to change religions. You know, have I behaved like that? Or, you know, what's my behaviour like? What have I done? And am I perfect? Why am I expecting other people to be perfect? And I think we don't always just do it with individuals and in life and in the spiritual community. We do it with the spiritual, we do it with groups, we do it, we can do it with the spiritual community, which of course we then made the spiritual community into a group. So often people resign, don't they, because something's happened. Maybe in their part of the spiritual community or their part of Triratna, you know, it's not the whole shebang, but it's just very hard for them to kind of get over whatever it is. And cynicism, the other thing we can fall into, cynicism. You're pulling your face there, apparently. Yeah, so, you know, we're trying to hide our scars, our wounds. We don't want to go there, it's too painful. So we're kind of, yeah, it'll all end in tears. That was one of mine after a very bad heartbreak many years ago. Anybody said to me they were getting into a relationship, I go, we'll all end in tears. I got told off by my community that I had to stop it. Parami being one of them. Yes. Well, sort of, in a way, it does all end in tears, doesn't it, or death or something, but, I mean, it's not the approach to take. It's one known sort of cynicism. So you have to look at your own shadow side, really. Yeah, so denial of the positive in others, but you also got a sort of self-betrayal where you give up on your own sort of dreams and ideals. I mean, they interlink, don't they? So if the spiritual community's fallen off its pedestal and become a group, you know, you had ideals and values around that, didn't you? And you give it all up. You know, you go back to material life and... why would I... Well, you know, how could I have been so stupid to join this outfit and, you know... I'll never fall in love again. It's the song, is I'll never fall in love again. And the last one that he suggests is paranoia. So we've been hurt and there were sort of We don't want to be hurt again. Life's about, you know, things happening, isn't it? Getting hurt, being able to sort of work with that and being able to sort of take obstacles onto the path, being able to be open to loss, which makes, you know, if you can really open to loss, your heart opens. You can, you know, you can be empathic to that in others. You can grieve with others. You know, it kind of leads to so many things, doesn't that openness? But the closing down, you know, just really, really close down. So the paranoia, if there's been loss, you want everything pinned down. You want contracts and stipulations and conditions. You know, you want to know where you stand. Absolutely, the prenup. And yeah, so all these things are about trying to sort of shut down on that kind of woundedness, hurt. They could sort of blossom into love and compassion and bodhicitta to sort of close down and fix samsara, really. And I guess they all come out of a sense of kind of naivety, an illusion about the nature of the world. Oh, nearly there. So that's all about blame externally, but we do blame internally, and we often switch between the two, don't we? So external blame manifests as kind of anger and judgmentalism, self-righteousness, and internal blame manifests as irrational guilt, irrational, these days it's called toxic shame, you know, low self-esteem. You know, we recognise those feelings. I mean, often it's quite quick, doesn't it? Sometimes we're more prone to one than the other. Sometimes we kind of shift. And, I came across a quote that said, in a way, they're not that different. They're both an outside finger wagging at you or wagging at the other, some kind of judgment, which is quite interesting. So we're trying to, if we go into self-blame, we go into shame again, we need to sort of recognise that feeling for what it is and trying to hold it, understand and hold it, you know, with a greater space of love and compassion. So yeah, I think it's quite interesting just to look at kind of our own views and assumptions that lie under our tendencies to blame. It might be like, you know, things aren't fair, why me? And we live in a victim, blame, compensation, litigation, increasingly that kind of culture, don't we, where that's where you go. And again, it's not that one maybe shouldn't take things to law or justice, but it just seems, yeah, we just live in that kind of culture. So there's a sort of sense of entitlement, I think, that arises out of that, that you should get what you want, things should never go wrong, and people shouldn't die, and et cetera, et cetera. And a friend of mine works in a clinic where she's on reception, and she was telling me the other day about, they have protocols, they have the way things are set up, they either have bookings or they have a walk-in, and they have a waiting time. And a lot of her time is spent sort of, people saying, well, it's not fair, and why can't I see the doctor now? And I need this drug, and why can't I have it now? And she, you know, does her daily kind of work is trying to sort of respond to. It's like, got to have it now, don't want to wait. And then she says, I haven't got the drug under the counter. You do have to go and see the doctor, so on and so forth. It's very interesting kind of out there in the world, isn't it? Anyway, I'm just going to finish in the last 4 minutes with three and apatrapia, which I'm sure we know very, very well, just to come back to the lines of the sutta. To me it all connects with giving up the power mode, being able to work with three and apatrapia. So three is that positive sense of shame, remorse, regret, isn't it? And three and apatrapia arise out of shraddha. Shraddha has to be there. Shraddha and the three jewels, shraddha in our own kind of potential to grow, shraddha in the sense of having this kind of growing, emerging sense of value, a response to value, a response to truth, a response to the Dharma. So that has to be there. And then when you know, for all sorts of reasons, we don't fulfill that, we break precepts, we don't quite act in the way we wish we could, the natural response is to feel remorse, regret, free. It's a kind of it's a positive and painful emotion, as we know, but there's a kind of, it's a natural response. And the same with apatrapia. The free is the inner, what the mind training calls the inner witness. So we kind of know oh, you know, wish I hadn't just said that, you know, that's hurt someone else. Or apotropia is a little bit more complex, isn't it? Because it's often translated as respect for wise opinion. So it sometimes it's translated as something much stronger than that, sort of fear of those with whom we have respect or something, which doesn't, you know, we don't want to go into that, do we? Fear. It's more like, well, you have genuine spiritual friends. You have a genuine relationship with your spiritual friends, with your chapter, with your Kayana Mitras, and you don't want to be out of harmony with them. I think that's the best way of looking at it. You know, you appreciate them. You don't think they're perfect, but they imbue values for you. You may look up to them in some way or other. There is, you know, a positive sense of spiritual hierarchy. And, yeah, you don't want to be out of harmony. I think that's the kind of key, I think, to what you might feel. And you don't have to even be around them. Maybe just, you know, you call a friend to mind, you've done something, and you call a friend to mind, you know, maybe that's a particular area of life that they share with you, and you kind of think, well, I'm going to need to confess that, and you already feel that sense of regret or remorse or apotropia. And it's very important enough work for us, isn't it, to distinguish between the sort of near enemies. Hri is irrational guilt. And so many of us still have kind of that tinge of irrational guilt. We seem to come into the Dharma with... I always think young people don't have that these days, but then I discover that they do very strongly. Just from having worked with some, you know, that they still feel... Yeah, they've got self-hatred, irrational guilt, they feel they're going to be told off, you know, all sorts of things. And then apotropia, it's authority projection, isn't it? So this is a lot of our work that we need to do in turning around the power mode to the love mode, that we learn and we help each other to discern the difference, to how, you know, how those manifest, how they feel in the body. Someone confesses something that they don't need to confess because it's not a breaking of the precept. You know, we go into that very thoroughly, as well as working with the whole area of blame. So I think it's very, very important, because I think the spiritual community runs, as it were. It runs on the love mode, and it runs on Hri and Apotropia in terms of faith, and then in terms of, you know, that responsiveness to oneself and others, that ethical sensitivity, that growing ethical sensitivity, that ability to take responsibility, to forgive, not to blame. You know, it has so much kind of in it, these two lines, really. The opposites, I guess, maybe are less likely to arise in us, hopefully, but the far enemy of free is... I don't care. I just don't care. I revel in my, you know, I rejoice in my kind of unskillfulness. Sort of self-congratulation. I got drunk as a skunk last night. No, I don't care. I don't know if we go that far, but anyway, if you do about anything. Sometimes there's a sort of rebellion against irrational guilt, isn't there, that kind of people go into that for a bit. But, it, you know, in a way it needs to be a phase, and maybe... maybe a sort of conscious working with others where you kind of help a sort of moral rebellion. And, you know, the other one in terms of respect for wise opinion is very similar. I don't care. I don't care what they think. Maybe I'll just stop there. I mean, I haven't got much more, actually. Just that I just think that all of that leads to confession, doesn't it? The ability to, you know, there's a lot one could say about forgiveness, which I didn't really go into even in the talk, but yeah, to not blame. If you can sort of withdraw, renounce blame, we're starting to enter that whole arena of forgiveness, and not just forgiveness of other, but forgiveness of self and forgiveness of life, isn't it? You know, a deep understanding of life. It's Kshanti in that deepest level, isn't it? And so renouncing blame, cultivating love, cultivating Hri and Apotropia, Shraddha, forgiveness, and confession are all aspects of changing power into love.